This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So the first thing we're going to talk about is what happens to people who are missing their teeth. And this is just one example of somebody who are missing their teeth. And they don't necessarily want to lose all their teeth. As you can see in this particular patient here, there's two teeth remaining in the lower jaw. And though these teeth, in the big picture, may not be helping this patient very much, there is an emotional connection that patients have to their teeth, and they don't necessarily want to lose their teeth. And one of the challenges does become for us to sort of figure out, are the teeth in the way of providing a restoration for this patient in the long term? So that is always something that's challenging, and we want to make sure that we're addressing what the patient really wants, right? It's we don't want to treat everybody like a cookie cutter sort of scenario. You walk in and you get the same treatment. So let's first talk about what happens when people lose their teeth. Decreased masticatory ability. That means decreased ability to chew. When people are missing all their teeth, and the reason why I'm starting to talk about this with patients who are missing all their teeth is because that's where we first started to use implants, because that was the group of patients that really benefited the most from having implants, and they really had no other choices. When we start talking about other applications today, you know, when somebody's missing one tooth, do they really need an implant? We did have other options before, like a bridge, for example, that was quite predictable until we weren't sure that implants had a similar success rate or outcome. We weren't necessarily going to give up what worked for us and try something new in that scenario. So when people are missing all of their teeth, there's decreased efficiency in chewing. And that varies from individual to individual. There's many factors that will impact that. Some of that has to do just with the quality of bone that somebody has, the gum tissue, how friable it is, how much saliva they may or may not have in their mouth, how they adapt to something artificial in their mouth, how early they got these prostheses. So, you know, in the 40s and 50s, it was not uncommon for younger people to have all their teeth removed and get dentures. And those people adapted to them at a younger age. It's not the same for somebody who's a lot older and hasn't had that experience wearing a prosthesis. It is sometimes more challenging in that group. So if you look at studies looking at the ability of patients to chew effectively in a scenario when they're missing their teeth and they're wearing dentures, studies will say as low as 5% to as high as 30% in terms of comparing to having their own natural teeth in their ability to chew. So there is a significant drop. Some of the studies will say that dentures, in the best case scenario, are only about 20% as good as having your natural teeth. You will, however, find some patients who've had dentures all their life and they don't know any different, and they chew things amazingly well. As dentists, sometimes we're surprised as to how poorly fitting a denture is, but the patients worked and adapted. I'll never forget when I was a resident, there was a young lady who came in, and her upper denture that she'd had since she was 17 years old, and she was in her 40s now, had broken. It was like four pieces. And I was like, so how long ago did this denture break? And she says, oh, it's been broken for about 3 or 4 years, but it was only broken in two pieces and I could manage it. Now it's broken in four and it's become challenging. And it's like, you know, gymnastics in the mouth. But those sort of patients are very able to adapt. And from a dental standpoint, those patients are very much more predictable for us to treat successfully because we know they can work with something that's really broken down. On the other hand, you'll see, say, patients sometimes who've got, from a dental perspective, a very good denture, but they can't chew effectively with it, you know, and that's just their ability to adapt and not able to chew as well with a prosthesis. So there's a lot of variation, and we spend a lot of time trying to figure out what a patient's complaints are, what they can, what they cannot do with a denture. Because as you see, when we'll go through the clinical scenarios with implants, there's many different ways we can use implants, from as little as having maybe just two implants to hold a denture to as many as having eight and having screwed in teeth. So how do you decide what is appropriate for each patient depends a little bit on what their chief complaint is, to examine their mouth to see what they've got and what is not working for them. Comfort is an important part of it. If patients have thin tissue, thin gum tissue, if you think about it, when you're wearing a denture, you've got your jawbone, you've got a denture that's made of a hard piece of acrylic plastic resin, and you've got these gum tissues that are being squished between bone and hard tissue every time you bite down. You know, it's sort of walking on the street and having a pebble in your shoe, and you're constantly getting impinging on that little pebble. And some people's gum tissues are way more friable, delicate than others. Certain times, certain medical conditions, like if somebody's had radiation therapy for a cancer, that tissue becomes much more friable and they're not able to tolerate a regular tissue. So comfort is an important part of it. But a big part of it is psychological. You know, there's lots of patients who just cannot or do not want to accept having something that is removable and goes in and out of the mouth. I remember when I was a little kid, my grandmother had dentures, and every evening they'd be sitting in the bathroom in a little glass and water, and it was like, what is that? You know, we didn't want to go close to that as kids because we were sort of afraid that something was going to happen. But on the other hand, I have patients who will come in to see me and will not want their spouse in the room at the same time because their spouse has never seen them without having a denture in their mouth. So it's a big psychological component for them to make sure that nobody sees them without sort of a major part of their body, their face, missing. And so there are huge psychological components. And the fact that losing teeth is important, and sometimes, like that picture that I showed you, the last two teeth, they want to hang on to them. They just don't want to because it's that last sort of connection to having their own teeth. And if that's gone, that impacts them significantly. So a typical patient that we would see who's missing all their teeth, as you can see here, this is the jawbone. This is a radiograph, a Panorex X-ray. It's two-dimensional. It's a good sort of what we would call a scout film to show us how much bone is available in the lower jaw, how much bone is available in the upper jaw. Basically looking for bone that's adequate for allowing us to put implants. And what anatomical structures are there that will probably interfere with placing an implant. So, for example, in the upper jaw, you can see this sort of dark area. I don't know how well it's showing up there, but these are your sinus cavities, the maxillary sinus, and you have your nose up in here. So if you look down from the bottom of the sinus or the floor of the sinus to the jawbone here, it's very little. It's not very tall. So that would not allow us to put an implant in that's long enough to be predictable over time. In the lower jaw, when you look at this portion here, if we were to, if you look at my face here and I've got my fingers at two points, this is where a nerve exits our lower jaw. It's called the metal nerve, and there's a metal foramen where the nerve comes out and supplies your lip. But between these two points, there is no nerve. Whereas back in this area, there's a nerve that's going through the jaw. If you remember going to your dentist and you get a Novocaine injection in your lower jaw, you get an injection way back, right? And that entire half of your jaw gets numb, including your lip and half of your tongue, because that's where the nerve enters the jawbone. And so we got to make sure there's enough room or enough bone above that nerve for us to be able to put an implant. But when people are missing their teeth and the bone resorbs or shrinks away, we don't always have enough bone there to allow us to put a screw in. So we're limited to the areas in between the metal foramen, but we need to be able to evaluate that. Today, we've gone a few steps further than just looking at a traditional X-ray. If we have any question about it, we are able to get a CT scan or a three-dimensional X-ray that'll show us much better where some of these anatomical structures are and allow us to plan better. We also know when patients are missing their teeth that there's the bone loss that's going to occur is going to be ongoing. When you lose your teeth, the bone doesn't just stop resorbing. There's two parts of the jawbone. There's the basal bone, your bottom of the bone, and then there's what we call the alveolus, so the portion that sort of holds the teeth in them. When the teeth are removed, this alveolus has no function or no purpose, and the alveolus is going to resorb. In fact, if you see children, like a group of patients that I treat here in a condition called ectodermal dysplasia, where they're born without having any teeth, they don't have any of that alveolus or gum because teeth never developed, so the alveolus never developed. They're down to basal bone. So when we look at this, we know that this bone loss is going to be ongoing. And therefore, you know, sometimes it may be advantageous to put implants in early because they have been shown to hold the bone and not let it continue shrinking away, especially in areas like I pointed out here where the nerve is close or the sinus is close. If you lose a certain amount, you may not be able to place an implant. We have methods today of trying to graft bone and things, but, you know, they work, but they're not as good as putting implants in your own bone. We would be much more comfortable having your own bone to put an implant in. Grafted bone success rates are good, but not as good as native bone. We also know that the jawbone, the lower, the alveolus and the mandible of the lower jaw resorbs at a rate of 3 times as much as the upper jaw. So there's been a lady in Scandinavia who's been following patients for over 25 years in a longitudinal study and has measured changes in how fast bone is lost in the lower jaw 3 times as much. And typically, it's the lower jaw that when patients are missing all their teeth, that they have the biggest problems. Most people don't complain about an upper denture. They complain about the lower denture. And that's interesting because from our standpoint, an upper denture, when you have no teeth, it's working against gravity. We have to work against gravity to help it to stay up there. But because we have the entire palate to cover, the roof of the mouth, we have sort of a much broader surface area. It's kind of like a snowshoe. You know, you're spreading the load over a wider area. But you're also able to get a suction or a seal around the edges, and therefore the upper denture stays in place very well. The lower jaw is very different. It's thin. The dentures are sort of horseshoe or U-shaped, and the gum is thin. And every time the tongue moves, which happens when you're talking, when you're swallowing, when you're eating, there's a tendency for the denture to lift. And when the denture lifts or moves around, then food particles that you have in your mouth are going to get underneath there, and then you bite down and it hurts. And so, you know, you show up to the dentist and it's like, oh, I got a sore spot, or I had a sore spot yesterday, but that occurred when you ate a raspberry or sesame seed or something got in there, and a couple of days it's healed up. It's not really the denture, it's just something that got underneath. So the key parts about how implants really help us are to be able to hold the prosthesis in place better, to make it stable so it doesn't move around, and when you bite down, you don't squish on the tissue, right? That's sort of the key part of how implants are beneficial to us, because they allow us to make a prosthesis, whether it's a denture or a crown or a bridge, that can be anchored to something in a much more stable, much more solid manner. So let's talk about this word osseointegration, because if you look at history, you know, the Egyptians, for example, the people died when they lost their teeth, because once they lost their teeth, they couldn't chew their food anymore, right? And so they didn't live into their 70s, 80s, and 90s like people do today. I mean, people would die in their 30s and 40s when they lost their teeth. So for the folks who are rich, the kings, the pharaohs, whatever they were, there are lots of examples where they would actually take teeth from somebody else and try and attach them with wires to their other teeth. They would take teeth from animals. They would take ivory and they would carve them into teeth and try and put them into people's mouths. But none of these techniques worked. Dentists have tried to make implants for at least 150 years. If you go back to the dental literature, and I'll show you some examples in a little bit, and they didn't work. And part of the reason is because, you know, the best things get discovered accidentally. Somebody has to be sort of thinking completely outside the box, not really thinking the way the dentists do. So as dentists trying to create an implant, we were sort of in that mindset that we want to create a tooth. So we want to create a tooth to work like a tooth, and we were bringing in all the problems that are associated with that. So Professor Brånemark, he just passed away last December. He probably is one person who's made the most significant impact to the way somebody like me practices dentistry today because of the impact that dental implants have had. So he's an orthopedic surgeon, actually, and he was working in the mid-50s in Sweden trying to figure out how the bone heals when a bone is injured. And obviously, we're talking about the 50s, right? So science is different. And so what he came up was a lab model where they had the long bone of rabbits, and they created an opening and basically made a chamber like a periscope. And they wanted this piece of metal embedded in this long bone of the rabbit in, and then there was a sort of periscope coming out through the skin, and there was a little glass opening through which a microscope, he could look through and over a period of about, 45 or 60 days, study what cells were flowing in that area and what was happening with inflammation, with injury, how the bone was healing. At the end of the study, when they tried to remove this metal chamber, they were unable to get it out, right? And a light bulb went off because he was like, wow, that is really interesting, because he had a piece of metal that was embedded in the bone and came through all of the soft tissue in the skin exposed to the environment, right? And what does that do? That sort of gives a pathway for bacteria to go in because it's a punctured wound that you have, and the body is trying to heal that. If you go back to teeth for a minute, our teeth are the only structure in our body that's actually anchored to the bone, but then comes through soft tissue into the mouth. And we consider the mouth sort of dirty. It's not sterile, right? We've all got bacteria in our mouth. And so how does the gum or the soft tissue seal around this tooth to prevent bacteria from going in? And we'll talk about that in a second again. So he was really intrigued by the fact that this piece of metal couldn't come out. Now, his lab technician made this metal chamber out of titanium. And the reason why they picked titanium was because they knew titanium was relatively inert. And since they were studying the effect of trauma, injury, inflammation, healing, they wanted to have a metal that didn't create a reaction from the body to that metal. So they used titanium. And for some magical reason that we don't even understand today, the bone grew onto the surface of this titanium. It treated it almost similarly to if you have a bone in your body and you fracture your bone, what do the doctors do to help repair that? When I was a kid and I'd fall down and bust my metatarsal or some part of my arm, they would put me in a plaster cast. And the purpose of the plaster cast was very simple. It took the bone, the surgeons called it, you reduced the bone so that the broken bone was lined up correctly, and you put a cast around it, and you left it for 6 or 8 weeks. The purpose of the cast was to prevent the two pieces from moving, right? And if the two pieces didn't move, the bone would heal up. Right? Today, surgeons don't use a cast as much. They go in and do surgery and they plate it. Right? You'll hear all these football players, they break a... I remember I was at a 49er game a few years ago when Dana Stubblefield, I think it was, fell down and his whole fibula was fractured and the bone was coming out through the skin. He was walking in less than 4 weeks because they went in and took a plate that connected the two pieces together. But the key there was it was rigidly connected so the two parts didn't move and the bone healed up. All right? So in this situation, this bone growing onto the surface of titanium is very similar. For some reason, these cells that we call osteoblasts, grow onto the surface of titanium, treating it like two pieces of bone that will heal. Now, if you think about the wound healing that I talked about in fracture, you have to make sure that this implant or titanium is in there stable and it's not moving during this healing period. Right? And that's going to be an important thing for you to remember when we talk about why it takes so long for you to have a tooth on an implant that you can bite on or chew on or use, because we need to give it that time for it to heal. Now, if you look at this other slide over here, what you see is you see these cells of bone, you see the titanium, but in between you have what we would call a fibrous connective tissue. So similar to a bone that's fractured, if those two pieces of bone were not held together rigidly, were not stable, and they were moving, that bone would never heal. You'd get fibrous union or fibrous connection in between, and that's what would break down, all right? So dentists, when we were trying to have implants, we were actually creating this model. And the reason why we were creating this model, because that's how your tooth is attached to the bone. Your tooth is attached to the bone with a little ligament. We call that the periodontal ligament. And that ligament is important to allow teeth to move. So I don't know how many of you had braces growing up, but the only reason orthodontists can move teeth is because there's a ligament between the bone and the root. So when you put wires and you put a force or a pressure and you stretch that ligament on one side, right? When you stretch the ligament wants to go back. It's like an elastic band, and so it brings the bone with it. On the other side, where you compress the ligament, that bone resorbs so the tooth can move, all right? That's how braces work. In an implant, that's not going to happen. When you put an implant in, you can put braces on it. You can try to put as much load on it. It is not moving anywhere once it's integrated because it's really part and parcel of the bone. Now, the other important part to realize is the ligament. We've all heard of gum disease or periodontal disease or periodontitis. Really, that's what's happening. The bacteria are entering through your mouth, between your gums. You go to your dentist and they take a probe and they measure and they say 3, 4, 5, 6, or all those numbers that they call out. That's sort of the normal space that exists between your gum and the tooth. The deeper it gets, the longer it gets, the greater the number, the more bacteria are going to get in, and basically they're going to cause inflammation and breakdown in this periodontal ligament, and then the bone's going to resorb from that bacterial infection. That's periodontitis, and that's how you lose your teeth. So really, we would say that this ligament tooth to bone was God's mistake on how teeth were designed, because if the teeth were designed like titanium to implant, maybe we wouldn't have had that problem because they would stay in place, okay? So we talked about the fact that this is so solid. So Professor Brånemark, I mean, this slide is probably not politically correct in this day and age, because after the study was done in rabbits, the next part of his study was to test this concept in a dog. So they had beagle dogs. They would extract teeth in these beagle dogs. They would put these titanium implants in, let them integrate, attach a tooth. And what he would demonstrate here is you could hang this poor dog by this tooth. The whole weight of the dog was on this implant and tooth, and it was not moving and not breaking and not coming off, all right? So I know this is not a good slide for us to show, but it demonstrates the point as to what's going on. So when you start looking at this, then Professor Brånemark coined the word osseointegration. And basically, it was a very simple definition, and my colleagues in this dentistry are arguing about this definition because we know a lot more. We have better tools to figure out what's going on. But when he coined this word in, I think it was the late 60s or early 70s, he said it was a direct functional and structural connection between living bone and the surface of a load-bearing implant. That's really important, the load-bearing implant. Because if I put a piece of metal in the bone and I don't put any pressure or force on it, it's going to sit there, right? I can take a screw and put it in this wall, and that screw is going to stay there. This wall is probably cheap block board, right? It's not solid teak wood. But if I go and try and hang a heavy picture on that, it's going to fall down if it's not being anchored stably in the wall correctly. So basically, we want a situation that's loaded. We just don't want a piece of titanium in the bone. We want to be able to put a tooth on it on which people can chew, and most people can exert a lot of force when they chew, right? So if this was to break down, if this interface was to break down under chewing, it would not help us in any way in restoring teeth, right? So the importance of structural load over time. How did he accomplish this? So there are two key parts to achieving osseointegration based on Professor Brånemark's original ideas. The first one was atraumatic surgery. So when you're putting the screw in the bone, you have to drill, you know, like putting any screw in any wood or metal, you have to drill a hole. And you have to be able to put that screw into the hole. Now, in bone, we want to make sure that it's atraumatic, because if you're drilling the bone too fast, too quick, to you're generating heat, and that's going to kill the bone cells in that area, and then you're going to have dead bone that you're going to put a screw in, and it's not going to work very well, right? So atraumatic surgery is a critical part of it. So in order to put an implant in, I don't do the surgery myself. My surgical colleagues do. I'm a prosthodontist. I sort of say this to people that you want to build a house, you don't go to an engineer and say, okay, dig some foundations in here. You actually go to an architect and you sort of say what type of house you want, how many floors, what is it going to support? And then the engineer, based on those drawings from the architect, actually plans the foundation. So I'm sort of like the architect, and then the surgeons, I joke with them, they're sort of our subcontractors, though there are a lot of prosthodontists like me who actually do the surgery as well. I'm not into blood, and I don't like that as much. So it's a painful procedure. I don't want to have call if there's an infection or something like that. So I do the designing, and I do the finishing and making the prosthesis, and I work with other specialists. So atraumatic surgery is a key part. To put an implant in, they start out by drilling a small hole, and they slowly go to a bigger drill. There's a whole sequence of drills that you go through to gradually enlarge that opening to match the size of the titanium screw that's going to go in. The very last part is you tap the bone, right? So you're creating the threads, and that actually goes about 5 revolutions a minute. So if you think about it, that is really, really slow. When you go and see me as a dentist, and if I have to, you know, if you have a cavity and I got to grind out your cavity or shape your tooth to get a crown, that drill that makes that awful sound that most people don't like and sprays water, that's going at over 100,000 revolutions a minute, right? If I use that same drill in the bone, I'm going to be killing the bone really quickly. So we can't afford to do that. The second part of this is a period of healing without load. That is really important for you to understand, because if you're thinking about how we talked about a fractured site, if we put the implant in and we put load on it right away, it's going to start moving. And if it's going to start moving, you're going to get fibrous union, right? So it's important that you leave it. And the reason why we say a period of healing, because that varies from person to person. It could be 2 months in somebody. It could be 6 months in somebody else. We don't know that. So in the old days, the traditional way of doing implants was you put an implant in. So you had the gum. You made an incision. You opened up the gum. You drilled the hole. You put the implant in. You covered the gum up. And you waited for 6 months. At the end of 6 months, you went back. You opened the gum. You connected a little post. It came through the gum into the mouth, and then you made a tooth that got attached to it, right? But the moment this technology came into the United States in the mid-'80s, early 80s, nobody here wants to wait. They don't want their teeth 6 months from now. They want their teeth yesterday, right? So people like us and other research institutions have been trying to push the envelope. And there are instances when you can actually place an implant and put a tooth on it right away. But there are very few instances where that's actually indicated and where it's going to be predictable in the long run. If you Google stuff, you'll hear things about teeth in a day, teeth in an hour, immediate load. These are all scenarios where you're not giving it that long-term healing period, but there are factors that are important. One of them could be that when you put the screw in the bone, that in itself, when the screw goes in, it's very tight, it's very stable. So for that, you have to have dense bone. Maybe you have to have an implant screw thread design that is really active in engaging the bone versus sitting in there passively. As I said before, the bone has to be dense. And maybe you put a tooth on it, but the patient can't bite on it. Or we tell you, you know what, you've got your teeth. They look good. You can speak with them, but you're on a liquid diet. Okay, so what good does that do from my perspective? You know, and you are then giving yourself, you're decreasing your success rate a little bit when you do that. And so you have to think of physiology. There's nobody who can make the bone grow on that same day and the bone become mature. It's going to take some time. There have been changes in technology where the surface of this titanium that we're talking about has been modified. So the titanium that's used is referred to as commercially pure titanium. In fact, it's really not titanium that the bone grows onto. Titanium is pretty active. If I was to take a piece of pure titanium and put it out here, it's going to develop an oxide layer on it right away. Okay? And it's that oxide layer of titanium that the bone grows onto. So that oxide layer has to be clean, not contaminated, because if it's too thick, you may actually lose the implant. But any metal surface, as you know, is not hydrophilic. It doesn't like moisture. It doesn't like water coming on it. So how does bone grow? When you put the implant in, blood cells are going to first come. There's fluid, right? And so if you look at it, it's the contact angle issue. You'll get little droplets of fluid on the titanium, but it won't be all the way through. So you're going to get bone only on few surfaces. So in the late 80s, we did some studies at UCLA where we looked at how much bone implant interface was there, right? So if we looked at bone and implant, the contact, was it contacting the entire 100% of that surface area? And it was not. It was only about 67%. The rest were just spaces or air bubbles or vacuoles, right? There was no 100%. So what the companies are doing today are they're modifying the surface of this titanium to make it more bioactive, more bioreactive. They're making it more hydrophilic, so the more fluid, right? So if I put water on it, instead of it bubbling, coming up into a little droplet, it's actually spread out on the entire surface. And if it's spread out on the entire surface, I'm potentially going to get more implant, or more bone to grow on that surface and not have empty spots in between. So the idea there is, well, if that's happening, maybe we don't have to wait 6 months. We can wait maybe 3 months and go in. But you still have to think about the bone may not be as dense at that point to load right away. So we talked about osseointegration and the implants, which are screw type. Now, these are examples of what people did before, because when patients had no teeth, they were really dental cripples. And in some situations, I mean, this looks like piece of, I don't know what, modern art could be that somebody designed. It was sort of custom made out of chrome cobalt. It was made to rest on the surface of the bone, which doesn't make sense, right? Because if you take this, like what looks like a little saddle, and you put it on bone and you put pressure, what's bone going to do if it has constant pressure on it? It's going to resorb. So that's what would happen. You'd get spaces underneath, you'd get an infection, and these kind of things had about 5-10 year survival rates of less than 50%. People would have these posts getting infected. You would get put on antibiotics and then it would get better. But, you know, there was really no good alternative. You wouldn't do anything like this today. This is a sort of a patient that I saw from the 70s. She's still actually a patient of mine. We keep slowly taking bits and pieces of this out as it gets infected. Other sorts of implants, you can see how archaic. Most dentists kind of design these in their backyard or their garage or other places. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, yeah, people were coming up with different ideas without really an understanding of the biology of what was happening. And the other thing they were doing, they were putting them in and putting a tooth on it right away. So some people do think that if you design an implant to look like what you see here today, but you did the surgery atraumatically, right, and you didn't load it right away, some of these may work as well. We don't know, because we're not going to go back to using something that didn't work in the past when we have a pretty predictable, what we refer to as a screw-shaped implant that's osseointegrated, right? So because of that, things got more standardized. No dentists are making their own implants, right? These come in standard diameters of standard lengths. It's a stacked system where you have an implant, which is a screw, and you can see these are the numbers that tell us what the length of the implant is, how much bone, 7 millimeters up to 20 millimeters. And after this implant's integrated in the bone, the second part is this little post that gets connected. This post gets connected to the top of this implant, like right here, with this screw. And then this little piece becomes part of the teeth that we're going to make, and it gets screwed in to this, right? So it's an implant, an abutment or a post, and then the tooth that goes on top of it. And you'll see examples of this in the middle. As we started to do things that we needed to be a little bit more cosmetic, more aesthetic, we sort of eliminated the middle piece here, and we were able to have sort of a preformed plastic pattern that we could use that fit directly to the top of the implant. And your dentist or dental technician could wax to this and make a crown. You know, like how we made gold crowns, lost wax technique. You wax them, you cast them, and you would do the same thing here, and you would end up with a restoration. All right. So I've given you a background of how implants actually came into being predictable, how they work, the important part being titanium is a critical component, atraumatic surgery is a critical component, and the fact that you are not loading them right away. You're giving them a period for the bone to grow and mature on the surface before you can start loading them. So now I'm going to share with you some examples of how we actually utilize these implants. And I'm going to split them into three categories. The first one is edentulous, which means somebody who's missing all their teeth, like the upper jaw that you see here. The second category is partially edentulous, where they're missing one or two teeth. And the third is a sort of cancer reconstruction, which is something that I hope none of you ever need, but it's a part of what I do here at a major medical center, working with our head and neck surgeons and reconstructive surgeons in rebuilding people's mouths where they have to be removed from cancer. All right, so partially dentulous would be one tooth, and then somebody like this who's lost a major part of their face because of a cancer, and we're trying to make some sort of prosthesis to make them more presentable in society. So let's talk about the edentulous patients first. And I'm going back to not a lot of data here to show you because it's pretty predictable. But this is one of the first papers that was published in 1981. And this came out from the people in Sweden. And what's really interesting is in this day and age, people like to publish data and publish papers before they've even got good follow-up on it, right? Because they're worried that somebody else is going to beat them to the Nobel Prize. So they got to get their data out there first. And sometimes there's problems with that because they haven't really evaluated them long enough to see what's going on. And the Swedes were very good about this. They did not let the rest of the world know that they had the system of replacing teeth till they had a 15-year follow-up on this. Right? They reported a 15-year follow-up in 1981. This idea of osteoregenerative implants came to North America in 1982, in Canada, actually, in Toronto, the University of Toronto. A gentleman by the name of Professor Zorb was the first one who introduced it to North Americans. And I think the first dental implant was placed at UCSF probably in 1985. So you can see how long it was already out there. But what they showed was maxilla is the upper jaw, and mandible is a lower jaw, and you can see the success rates. And there's two numbers that you're seeing here. You're seeing 89% and 81% and 100% and 91%. And what does this mean? This is a really important part because in medicine, you got to realize nothing is 100%, right? If somebody's telling you it's going to work all the time, they either haven't done it long enough or they're just making it up. So how do these guys get an outcome that's 100% successful? Well, really, what they're looking at is this two different data struct points that they're looking at. The 91%, so we say a patient comes in and has no teeth in their lower jaw, and their objective is to be able to get teeth that are held in place by implants, all right? So in that one patient, let's say the dentist decided to place six implants, but out of the six implants, one implant didn't take, five did. But the dentist could still use the five implants to make the patient a prosthesis, right? Or teeth that were attached to the implant. So the patient's complaint, patient's not coming in saying, I want six implants. Patient comes in and says, I want teeth. So the 100% is teeth that were supported by implants. So in the lower jaw, in 100% of their patients, they were able to provide a prosthesis that was supported by implants, but the success rate of implants was 91%. That means if 100 implants were placed, 9 of them failed. Fortunately, not all 9 failed in the same patient, right? They were scattered, 1-2, 1 in one patient, 1 in the other patient. So success rate of implants is 91%. Now that's great, but in a multiple situation, it's okay because I'm placing 5 or 6, and maybe one doesn't work. So for that reason, sometimes we do over-engineer the system, right? If you come in and we say, well, we need a minimum of 4, but if we're going to do the surgery, maybe we should just place 5 or 6, because if we lose one, then we're still going to be able to make a prosthesis in that situation. In the upper jaw, it was not so good. Only in 89% of the patients were they actually able to provide a prosthesis that was successfully supported by implants, and the success rate of implants was 81%. You can see, like, almost 20% failure. Now, why did that happen, right? I can't really answer that for you. We have some ideas as to what's going on in that situation. First of all, the upper jaw, the bone is much, much softer. It's not as dense as the lower jaw. The mandible bone is more like teak wood. The upper jaw bone is like sponge, okay? It's much softer. So when you put the implant in, that screw is not in dense bone. It's not rigid. It's not stabilized strong enough. That's one thing. The second thing that happened, if you remember that Panorex that I showed you, we said that in the mandible or the lower jaw, you could pretty much get decent length implants between the two mental foramen because there was no nerve structure impacting it. Whereas in the upper jaw, we had sinus cavities and we had a nose. So there was limited areas where they could get implants in. So you maybe couldn't get enough implants or you couldn't get implants that were long enough. It was very unusual to get 15, 17 or 20 millimeter implants in the upper jaw because there isn't that much bone. Right? So most of the implants in the upper jaw in their early studies were 7 or 10 millimeters, and there was a point when they actually stopped using 7 millimeter implants because they had a higher failure rate with that. Okay, so you understand this number discrepancy in statistics when you look at that. Statistics is really messed up, right? Most people could use statistics to show whatever point they want to make. All right, So when we start looking at the edentulous patients, then the ones who are missing all their teeth, we also have different types of prostheses that we can make. So we sort of classify them into three categories. We call one a hybrid bridge. A hybrid bridge is what you see here. So basically, you've got these implants or these posts, and you have teeth, which is like a denture, that's screwed on to these implants. So they're like sort of teeth on stilts. And this is really the original design that Professor Brånemark came up with in Sweden. And we do it this way today. It works really well in the lower jaw. It gives patients good access, as we'll talk about later, to get underneath and clean this bridge. But this is not going to work in the upper jaw. Because if in the upper jaw, when you smile and you show all this gap, you know, it's not going to look pleasing aesthetically. Also, you're going to blow bubbles of saliva. You know, whoever you're standing next to is going to get a shower from your saliva, and food's going to get stuck in there. So this sort of hybrid bridge is not something that we use in the upper jaw. It works really well in the lower jaw, but not so well in the upper jaw. So when we came to the United, and I'm going to go through an example of how this is done. You can see these are five posts that are sticking through the gum. Right, we go through all these steps. There's these metal pieces that all come pre-machined. Everything fits very precisely. We screw them in place. We make an impression. We are then able to try some teeth in wax first, which is sort of like the idea of a blueprint of what you want the teeth to look like. We want to know where the teeth are going to be, what the bite is going to be. We know where the implants are, and then we're going to have to figure out how we connect these two together. So that's an important part of what's going on. We make then a metal structure. In this particular image that you're seeing here, this is cast, the lost wax technique. This is where technology has changed some today, that we don't cast these things anymore. We actually digitally design them. So instead of me sitting there in front of a wax on a lab bench and using hot wax and making this thing up and then investing it and burning the wax out and casting gold into it. We sit on a computer screen. We take the model, we scan it, we design it three-dimensionally on a computer screen. That data gets shipped off to somewhere in Quebec or New Jersey or Sweden. And at that major manufacturing unit, they have what they call five-axis milling machines, and they take a puck of titanium and they cut out this particular thing. So they come much more precisely fitting, more predictable, and made out of titanium that we couldn't do today, right? So gold is gone because that used to add expense, but now the expense is with technology and with these companies. And then we have teeth, just like the denture teeth, that are attached to this metal structure. And when you look at the x-ray, you can see that these are the screws that are in the bone. You see how long they are in the lower jaw? This is sort of where that mental nerve is, where I was pointing to. The nerve tracks back this way, so we could only get implants in between the metal nerve. This is the post that sticks through the gum, the part that you see right about here, right? And then this is the frame with the teeth that gets screwed on. So the patient doesn't take this on and off. The dentist can if we need to, and we don't do this regularly unless there's a problem. When they come and see a hygienist to have them cleaned, the hygienist has good access and can get in here. But a very predictable result, because what have we done? We've given them a denture that's screwed in that's no longer sitting on the gum. So all the issues that we talked about that were painful, discomfort, pinching, food getting in there is gone. That doesn't happen, right? So this is one really good way of doing it. Today, technology-wise, what have we changed? I gave the same talk 5 years ago, and you know, basically, not much has changed content-wise. Some of the technologies have changed. So what do we do today? Well, we can design these in a way of what's called flapless surgery, so we don't have to cut your gums. If we get a CT scan, we can use the CT scan and virtually plan where the screws need to go based on the space. Then on that model, this what we call a surgical guide or surgical template gets milled. It's actually stereolithographically produced. That comes back. It gets screwed into the jaw with these little pins that you see right here. And then we can put screws or implants into the bone precisely where we planned them to. And if we wanted to give you teeth on that day, like we did to this patient when he walked out, we can have these teeth pre-made because we know what position the implants are going in, and we can very precisely deliver this to that point. And so when this patient leaves, they've got some teeth in their mouth, right? But these teeth are not for them to chew on. They're on a liquid diet. They're on a liquid diet for 2 months because though we've got 5 implants here, and you'll see the x-ray in a second, because we had a bridge that connected the 5 together, it's like having 5 posts that are connected with a horizontal. And when you do that, you're not allowing each post to move individually. You're splinting them together, right? All of us have backyard with a post, and you got one post, and you can move it around real easily. You have 2, 3, 4 of them. You connect them. They're not going to move as easily, right? So you can do this when you can rigidly splint. The other thing that's important is when we put this implant in the jawbone, we want to make sure that that implant is integrated. It's rigid. And we test that with how much Newton centimeter. So when we're putting the implant in, we have our drill is telling us how much resistance we're getting. And if we don't get a certain number of resistance, we know that that implant is not as stable in that bone because it's not so dense. And then we wouldn't call immediately loaded like we're doing right here, right? So there's multiple sort of guidelines that we do this on. This is sort of the technique that people have taken out and called it teeth in a day, all on 4. The biggest advertiser for this on a commercial way is something called Clear Choice that you'll see ads on television and newspapers all the time. And it's a technique that works, but it's not for everybody. You got to be very precise on whom you're using it for. So after 3 months, you know, and this, it's important at this stage when you put this temporary bridge on and you screw it on, you don't take this on and off. This got to stay in place for 3 months because if I'm taking this on and off, I'm now taking that implant and actually wiggling it and moving it, and I'm going to lose the implant. So you can't do that, right? In the early studies that were done on this immediate loading, they found out that the implants that they failed were where the temporary bridge broke and somebody took it on and off to fix it, and they were creating more trouble. So that was a problem. So once the implants are ready, you can see how well this is healed. The gums look healthy. We've sort of spread them out, 3 in the front. This gentleman had enough bone at the back that we could get implants in, so we didn't want to have a cantilever. I always tell my patients the best scenario is if I can have 4 implants, like a 4-legged table, spread out so the table is balanced on 4 ends and it doesn't rock. If I have only 3, it's going to move around a little more. If it's only 2, whatever sits on top is going to tip and move around. You can have all 4 implants in the front like this. It's not going to do the same thing, right? Because they're basically like taking 4 legs and putting in the middle of this table, and then I can tip this end down real easy. So you want the 4 as evenly distributed as possible. And so in this particular patient, you know, we put 5, but if this implant was not there, it would not have made a difference in the ultimate outcome. We could have worked with really these 4, 1, 2, 3, and 4, really evenly spread out. But not everybody has the bone available to allow us to put implants in that location, right? So it's not just where they ideally should be. I need to have the bone to place it in that location, or you, the patient, needs to have enough bone. And so then we make the final bridge, and that's what he looks like. And you can see here, this is all sort of, I couldn't have shown you this slide 5 years ago because this didn't exist. Right, so these implants were placed by what we call a CT scan guided surgical procedure, that they were placed planned virtually, put exactly where we wanted them. We made, and then this bridge that you see here is a titanium milled structure. You can see it's less dense than the previous cast gold that I showed you. All right, so it's great that we can do this. We can do a fixed bridge, but obviously if you're doing all of these procedures that I showed you, and we're using somewhere between 4 and 6 implants and making a screwed-in bridge, it's a pretty expensive procedure. And not everybody can afford that. That's one question. The second is, even if somebody could afford it, they may not have enough bone to allow us to put 4 implants because they've resorbed a lot of bone. So we have to have other options in order for us to be able to give patients a prosthesis where implants will improve their quality of life. So here, we've come up with an idea what's called an overdenture. Now, the Swedes didn't do this. They didn't know how to do this. This is something where the Americans actually made the changes because, as I pointed out, we told you that when people lose their teeth, the gums start to shrink, right? So we had a technique which was pretty popular, and the University of Washington actually did a lot of research in this to do what was called overdentures, where they left. So if you had a tooth that had a lot of caries or a lot of gum disease, they would actually cut the tooth off at the level of the gum, and they would leave the root in the bone, right? And if the root stayed in the bone, it could maintain that bone for you, and then the denture would sit on those bone, on those roots. So it had little solid spots to sit on, all right? And that was what was called an overdenture. So it was a very predictable procedure that we could do on those patients where they had good enough roots that we could keep, that were not infected, didn't have root canals, weren't fractured. So we said, you know what? Why can't we do the same thing with these implants? Why don't we place a couple of implants and use them to help hold a denture? Because what we really want, in order for this denture to be more predictable than not having anything, is something that allows this denture to not move around, right? So movement of a denture can occur in three directions. A denture can move away from the gum. It lifts up. It can move sideways, right, back and forth or side to side. Or it could move towards your gum when you bite down and you squish the gum tissue. So having implants helps prevent movement in all of these three different directions. And if we can completely stop movement in all three directions, that's when I have the most successful prosthesis. So when you have four implants, like the last one I showed you, five, and you make screwed in, that is going nowhere. It's not moving towards the tissue. It's not moving away from the tissue. It's not moving sideways. Patient's going to be completely comfortable. If we don't have that option and we go to something less than that, well, we're going to have certain amount of movement. But obviously, we're going to get some degree of improvement. So we have to be able to weigh the pros and cons of what the advantages are going to be. In this patient, there was not enough bone. All we could get was two implants. So we made a bar out of gold. And this denture had two little clips that helped snap the denture onto these clips. So that prevented this denture from moving away from the gum, right? It also prevented the denture from moving sideways. What it doesn't do is prevent the denture from moving towards the gum. So this back part of the denture right here, this is still going to move into the gum when the patient bites down, right? And when they squish into it, if their gingiva or their gum is delicate, friable, it's going to hurt a little bit. If you eat that raspberry or sesame and a little seed gets in there and you bite down, it's going to be like having a pebble in your shoe. It's going to hurt. It's not going to take that part away. So it's really important that when we plan these kind of things, patients understand what the outcome is going to be and what to expect from it. So overdentures are many different directions, right? We talked about four legs, which is ideal. So four legs equally spread out gives us the best scenario. Two legs is probably the weakest link because it's going to allow the most amount of movement. And there's all sorts of permutation and combinations in between in terms of how many implants we have and where they're placed. So in this particular patient, we were able to get four implants in there, but they weren't really spread out. So we couldn't have a denture that would provide this patient teeth all the way back. So the front half of this denture is anchored and supported by the implants, but the back is still supported by the gum. So there's going to be some play, and that's why the attachments that we use, these little gizmos that you see here, have to allow that play or that movement to occur, because if we don't allow that movement or play to occur, this basically, this part of the denture is cantilevered off the back of the implant, is going to place a lot of stress on those implants, and you may end up losing the implant. So we have to allow that play to occur to gain the support from the back. But a very predictable procedure for a number of patients. Typically, I would say that the first example that I showed with two implants works really well for that patient who's been wearing dentures for 30 years. Right? They got dentures when they're in their mid-20s, early 20s. They had one set of dentures, second set of dentures, did really well with them. And now they're older, they've lost a lot of bone, a lot of gum. The gums have become flat, the dentures are really sliding around. They have adapted to a denture, they know how to chew with a denture. All we need to give them is a little support, a little help. And you get two implants in a bar, they're going to do really well. On the other hand, if there's a patient who's never, ever worn a denture successfully, because it's uncomfortable, it hurts, it's painful, and you come in and say, you know what, I can't really do the five implants, I'm not going to do two implants for you because I know you won't be satisfied with those two implants either, because the problems of you biting down and impinging on that tissue is still there. I'm not taking away that issue, and therefore you won't be successful. If we can get four, maybe I'll have a little less movement. If I can, on the other hand, put implants like this that are four-legged table, like I talked about earlier, I can still make a denture that snaps onto it, goes in and out. We do that sometimes because it's easier for patients to keep that clean. It's harder for some patients to get in and clean around a bridge that's screwed in. Whereas if they can remove the denture, it's better access for them to be able to clean the prosthesis. And if you can look at this x-ray, you can see how this is a very stable denture. It's not moving anywhere, and the patient has the ability to remove it and clean the area better than they did before. But it is a prosthesis that goes in and out. It also, as you can see, we'll show you in a minute, some in the upper jaw, but because this denture goes in and out of the mouth, there's none of that gap that you were seeing in the bridge before. Remember that gap that I talked about, the teeth on stilts? Well, I can have this pink part of the gum replaced, and it doesn't collect food, doesn't show the area, and it's removable and much more aesthetically pleasing. And this is a patient from my ectodermal dysplasia group that was born with no teeth, and we were able to put implants in both the upper jaw and make a denture for him. And in the lower jaw, we were able to get some implants in the front and have him bite down and get teeth that he was screwed in, right? An example in the upper jaw that I talked about, 8 implants that were placed, a bar that was made to snap on. And then when you look at the prosthesis, this is the denture that goes in and out. These 3 clips help snap it on. And now when this patient bites down, they can chew on this just as if the teeth were screwed in. But they have the advantage of being able to remove it and clean it. They don't have the area in the upper jaw here of space and blowing bubbles of saliva. The other important part in the upper jaw is that when you lose your teeth, we talked about losing gum. But we don't lose gum only in the vertical component. It's not just height. We're also losing bone horizontally, right? So you're losing that gum that helps support your lip. Now, I can replace teeth, but if I don't replace that missing gum, you're not going to have support for your lip that's going to be cosmetically acceptable. So in this case, as you can see, this lady had lost her teeth many years ago and wore a denture and had significant resorption, and just having teeth here would not help support her lip. You can see how the lip looks really nice here versus having folds and being curved in or being concave, right? But you can see how thick this pink portion is, and that's the amount of gum tissue that she was missing. So even if I could, if I had enough implants to make screwed in teeth for her, it would not give us an aesthetically acceptable outcome because we needed that replacement for the lip part of it. The other challenge, and I'll show you this in a little bit in a few moments here, is when you lose teeth, the gums become flat, right? So if you look at natural teeth that she has down here, you can see there's a tooth and the gum kind of has this scalloped appearance to it. And the gum comes up and peaks in the middle. When you lose all your teeth, the gum becomes flat. So if I make a bridge and screw it in, my teeth are going to be very square because I can't make that gum follow that scallop. It only does that on teeth. So in the upper jaw where that's important, because I have the use of pink artificial material, I can make that pink material look like it's coming in there, and I can make the teeth more tapered and not be very square and block-like. So in the upper jaw, I tell my patients that it's not less than 10% of the time we're going to be able to make in teeth that are screwed in because they may not be aesthetically acceptable. You may not be able to clean them adequately. And so I always prepare them. We're going to go through this. We may get 8 implants, but in the end, you may end up having something removable. So from a psychological component, as we said, if there's some people who just don't want anything removable, they have to be prepared to accept the fact that they may end up with something removable because the fixed option, as we call it, may not fulfill all our needs from an aesthetic and functional standpoint. Right? So same sort of thing. This is how we do it today. This is a bar. The old bars that I showed you were cast. This one's milled out of a piece of titanium. The denture part, this metal component here that fits on top, is also milled out. This thing is so precise. It is so beautifully fitting in place that this gentleman, you can see in the inside of this denture, there's 3 little yellow clips, right? These are the 3 snaps that help hold it in place. But there's also 2 additional snaps. You may not be able to see it well, but it was prepared for 5 of them. Now, because this is precisely milled together, I'm going to go back here. Nope. This is the one I want to show you. These are the 3 clips. And this piece of titanium is milled or machined out of the same block as this. So this part of the metal fits in this like a glove. It doesn't move anywhere. It's so precisely fitting You know, I don't know if anybody in this room is a machinist, but if you did good machining, they were able to make parts fit together so good. This is really what it comes out like. So this gentleman, when he went home, he emails me and says, these new teeth are fantastic. They're great. They stay in place, but I can't get them out. Right? It was so tight and so solid in there with just three clips instead of five, he couldn't get them out. And so he came back and I actually removed two of the clips and had him just hold one clip because this bar is what we call the milled bar, but it's made to be very parallel. It's got a taper that's only 2 degrees on each side. So it's a total 4 degree taper. And then this part of the is made to fit that. So it's like two pieces of metal that fit precisely. And when they go all the way around the arch like that, it doesn't go anywhere. So in terms of function, it's absolutely ideal. So those are overdentures, right? Now, there are certain situations that we still do fixed bridges. This is what a fixed bridge would look like. If I'd shown you the slide here 5 years ago, this would be metal and porcelain. Today, it's zirconia and porcelain. Same thing, because we don't cast metal. We can use zirconia and add some porcelain to it. So this is a lady who's got 8 implants in her upper jaw, as you can see. That's the bridge that you just saw before. That's what the biting surface looks like. We always screw these to place, all right? We want them. We call them screw retained, because if there's ever a problem with this bridge, we can remove this little filling, unscrew this bridge, take it off, repair it, fix it, put it back in. If you had bridges on teeth, we can't do that. They have to be cemented on, because if they're not cemented on, they turn loose, you get decay on the tooth underneath it. So if you have a bridge and there's a problem, you have no choice but to cut the bridge off and completely redo it, right? Major problems for the patient, expense, a lot of time in the chair. These are screw retained and they look really good. So this is what you can see in her mouth. Remember what I talked about? I don't have the gum tissue following that scallop. Right? You see how this looks a little blocky, right? You're not getting that gum in there. But we take into account what has, this is the x-ray showing what this looks like. But when you look at this patient's smile, her smile doesn't show that gum. So that's an important part of our evaluation going into it, right? We put people into 3 categories. People like me, when you smile, you barely see my upper teeth, right? And then there's friends of mine, when they smile, you can see all of their gum. All the way up, right? We all know people like that. And it's just lip length, lip movement, how much jaw you have. So for me, the best patients to treat aesthetically are the ones whose lips don't move, because then it doesn't matter what things look like. I'm just joking about it. But the reality is that's an important part, factoring in to deciding what sort of bridge you're going to make for a patient and what's going to work in this situation for having a cosmetic or aesthetic outcome. This lady was a nurse and she had been wearing dentures for many years and didn't want to deal with it anymore, wanted teeth that were completely screwed in. She had lost so much bone that we were able to put implants in after grafting and being able to make porcelain teeth. And you can see here that we had to build all of this pink stuff to make it look aesthetic enough, because her lip would have to go all the way up to that point for this to show. So if you look at the smile, this looks very natural in her mouth, right? Because we're able to build. But if you look down here, we still left all these gaps. Like, if anybody's a St. Louis Cardinal fan, they would say, oh, that's the whatever the arch is, right? We got these arches in there so they can get in and keep these clean. So in deciding all of this, it's a juggling act between comfort, function, access for oral hygiene. Let's quickly move over to the single tooth scenario. Person missing a single tooth. This guy was actually a medical student here at UCSF, was playing basketball across, got elbowed, aggressive players they were with, fractured, the tooth had to come out. In the days when I was a resident, 1987, 89, we would have made a bridge. And what a bridge would involve would be taking these two beautifully healthy teeth, cutting them down to get a crown and putting a 3-piece bridge in there. So we were basically destroying or damaging teeth that were good to replace a missing tooth. Now, we didn't do implants in these people early on because the bridge worked quite well. We had good success rates. So we wanted to first make sure the first group of patients that the implants were done in were the patients who had no teeth, the edentulous patients, because those patients had no other choice, right? They were either wearing dentures that they were miserable with, or we did the implants. In this patient, we had to think about it, right? When you have something to compare and contrast, I tell my residents today, when they're sitting down and doing treatment planning, it is way more difficult than when I was a resident because there's more choices. And when you have more choices and more options, it's more difficult for you as the provider in presenting it to the patient and more difficult for the patient to decide what choice they're going to choose. If you only have one choice, life is easy, right? But implants today have made life in one way a little bit more complicated for us in that situation. So again, success rates, 5-year studies of these implants were pretty successful, multi-center. So when implants started becoming successful in the group of people who had no teeth, people said, you know what, there's an advantage. Let's try them in this kind of patient group where they're missing one tooth and everything is healthy. Can we use an implant in that situation? So a group of universities across the world got together, 2 in the United States, 2 in Europe, 1 in Australia. That's what this 5-year multi-study was. And they reported in 96 that they had 100% success in the lower jaw and 96.6%. Now here, it's 100% for one tooth, but only 5 years. Okay, that's an important thing to consider. 96.6% in the upper. So that means nothing to me because if I'm having one implant replaced and I'm that 1%, for me, it's 100% failure, right? Because implant failed in my mouth is not like that previous study that I showed you where you're having many implants and getting a prosthesis. If you're getting one tooth, it's 100% success or 100% failure. So we could treat patients like this. This is a young girl. She was congenitally missing. That means she was born without this one tooth in her mouth. Right, she's 18 years old, 17 years old, you know, perfectly healthy teeth. I wouldn't want to destroy these teeth by putting crowns on them, right? And so she doesn't want to walk around with a flipper for the rest of her life. Implant works really well. We have an implant. I'm able to make a temporary tooth on it. We use the temporary tooth to create the form of the gum tissue, make sure it looks healthy. And then we're able to make a final tooth for her, make an impression, and we're able to get a tooth in her mouth. All right? Very predictable. When you look at this, that's the implant. That's the tooth that's screwed in. This has been in her mouth 13 years, right? And it looks absolutely natural. None of you could look in this mouth and say that was a false tooth in there, right? It has nothing to do with the color match. That's pretty good too, but it has to do with the fact that the gum tissue looks normal. And the gum tissue looks normal here not because of the implant. We're able to gain the scallop because there's a tooth on either side. So the tooth on either side dictates that scallop or the presence of that papilla. When we move to missing two teeth, I'll show you that that's not going to happen. If it happens, we just got lucky. But in a single tooth, if the gum is there on the adjacent tooth, we're going to be able to make it look pretty good. It still doesn't look good as the one on the other side. You see there's a lot more gum tissue in here, but we're able to mask it and make it look pretty nice. Right? This is the one that I showed you, the basketball player. Right, single incisor. I'm going to go fast now because I'm just showing you examples of what's going on. Single tooth implant, you take it off, you make a tooth, looks pretty good. It's been in there almost 12 years. Okay? So this is a young lady who had a tooth that is pretty common. So you'll see most of this happens, single tooth in the front of the mouth. Young people, most of them had some sort of trauma. Either the tooth was playing basketball, young kids bicycling, if you lived in the Midwest and you played hockey, tons of people had hockey pucks busting their teeth. And basically this lady had a tooth that had a root canal, turned gray, fractured. So we're going to lose this tooth. We're going to take the tooth out. In her situation, we're actually going to put an implant in right away because there's no infection, and we can put a long enough implant that's going to be stable. We're going to make a tooth on it that provides, this is on the day of surgery. The tooth comes out, the implant goes in, and a temporary tooth goes on. You can see this temporary tooth is short because I don't want her to bite on it. I don't want no loading on it. I want no pressure on it. It's going to heal for a while. She's told no bagels, no sandwich, no corn on the cob, no apples. She's not eating anything on her front teeth, right? Because that would just knock this implant out. And then after it's healed, we've added now to the temporary to make it look good. This is still a temporary. You can see the grayness here of the screw hole behind. And then when it's finished, finally, I'm able to get a crown on the tooth. So you have an implant, really nice and long. That was important, right? That's why we could immediately load it, because we could get the screw all the way up in a bone and it was anchored to place solidly. We got what we call a post on, and then the crown that got cemented to place. Again, really good-looking tissue because the adjacent teeth have the gum on them. And this patient could walk around and not show, nobody could pick up that she had a false tooth in her mouth. We do this in the back of the mouth, missing tooth. Different examples, premolars, molars, very, very predictable. Sometimes we even try to create two implants with teeth because the molars at the back are teeth that we put a lot of force and pressure on. And sometimes we're not able to get a fat enough screw in there, so we want to get two because natural molars were actually designed with two roots. and there's a lot of stress. When you bite into something, if you want to break a pistachio nut, you don't do it with your front tooth, right? You do it with the back molar because you can crack it. And then the next day you crack your tooth and then you call your dentist, I chipped something. So you shouldn't be cracking those nuts. But that's an important part here. And very often in the back of the mouth when we're making these restorations, we do not make them out of porcelain. We make them out of gold. Because if you do bite on something that's hard and it's porcelain, porcelain is glass, it's brittle, it's going to chip. Okay? And the difference between an implant and a tooth, coming back to the ligament that I talked about earlier, when you have a ligament on this natural tooth here that you can see this sort of gap, that means it's like a shock absorber. When you bite down, the tooth moves a little bit. It gives a little bit. In an implant, we have no shock absorber, right? So when you bite down, there's no give. If you bite on something hard, it's going to be an impact. And when it's an impact, if it's glass, porcelain, it's going to chip. The previous chairman of my department used to say, if you want porcelain on your back tooth, I'm only going to guarantee it from the point you leave my office chair till you reach the elevator. After that, it's not guaranteed because that risk of chipping is pretty, pretty high, right? So we still recommend gold or titanium on those back teeth. Right. Partially dentulous, more than one tooth, same thing. We went through studies. It became successful. Somebody who was in a traumatic situation fell off a bicycle, knocked out three front teeth, right? We've got to, now what are we going to do? So we make him a temporary denture so he can walk around with something. Three implants get placed in there. We make a temporary bridge, and then we make the permanent bridge. And what I want you to point out to you here is this is our biggest challenge. We're not able to get the gum to fill in between these. You can see how the gum fills around teeth on a natural single, on an implant on a single tooth. I could get the gum to grow in there. I cannot get the gum to grow in there, right? So every time we do this, we need to know that smile line, because if this guy's smile line is like this, he's not showing it. And so he's happy. Okay, so this is one of my sort of patients that we treated that I could never, ever guarantee that I would get the same result again. This was maybe luck, maybe a little bit of planning, maybe her biology. Because if you look at her, she's got two teeth that are both hopeless and they have to come out. And I was able to get two implants and get the gums in. This treatment actually took 3 years to do. She had to wear braces. We had to move teeth to move the gums. All kinds of crazy things before we get to be able to get this outcome. Could I predictably accomplish this? Absolutely not, right? We can try if somebody really wants it, but we cannot guarantee that we're going to get the gum tissue to look like this. I have shown this slide many a times at dental meetings and asked people to identify which one is the implant. And nobody can ever say that they are both implants because of the way that gum tissue is turned out, right? This is a follow-up of this many years after. You can't tell that these two teeth are both dental implants. This does not happen very often. Right. So if you had a patient who had, and this was in a car accident and lost their teeth and had a missing gum tissue, we talked about the width. Now I can't make that bridge because there's this missing pink part and I have to be able to replace that. So we're going to make an overdenture. We're going to make an overdenture in the partially edentulous scenario. This is a bar and I've got, this is what it looks like, and then there's a denture that snaps on. So when it goes in its mouth, I'm replacing all of that pink tissue. Right? These photographs are not showing that pink very well. That matches a lot better to the natural gum. But you can see a little bit, he didn't smile so high in this, but this little pink part here is the most critical part. But we also needed this to support that portion of the lip. Right? So possible to replace it. Implants work really well. This is my mother. My mom is 84 years old, now 85, and these were done about 18 years ago. She was missing one tooth and had a bridge. It failed. Got three implants placed in her mouth. I told you about not wanting porcelain at the back, right? But my mom insisted on having porcelain because guess what? If it cracks or chips, she doesn't have to pay for it. So she insisted because I had treated my dad a few years before that. He had worn down his teeth and all his back teeth were full gold crowns. And my parents live in India and they went to one of my dental colleagues sees them in India and he says, Arun did all these gold crowns. He's a professor at UCSF, and he's doing gold crowns in your mouth. What the hell's wrong with him? So he calls me up and says, why didn't you give me all that new porcelain stuff? Because I said, Dad, you would break it in 2 days, right? It's not good. He clenches, he grinds his teeth, he bites on them. But the moment my mom came and she said, you know, I'm not going to get that gold like your dad. I want the porcelain. And she doesn't clench and grind her teeth as much. And they've survived for all these years, right? Predictable options. You can see what the implants look like. Typically, this is how I would make these on a patient if it was not my mom, right? There would be gold metal on the biting surface. We would give them some porcelain on the side because I'm worried about these things chipping. Now, today, and I did not include this in this slide, we can, you remember the fixed bridge I showed you on the lady and I said it was zirconia instead of metal? Zirconia is white. So we have the ability today of making these things out of zirconia. The problem with the zirconia at the moment is that it's very bright. It doesn't have good color. So it looks sometimes like a toilet bowl. You know, it just doesn't have that translucency to it. It's just opaquey dense. And so if it's way back in the mouth, you can sort of mask the color, it may work right. But if you, in the front of the mouth, that case I showed you, we had to put porcelain on it. And so then that's, it's sort of the same thing. We could design it like this. This would be like a very blocky white, and then it would be porcelain on the side. All right, that's typically what we do. This is the upper jaw, same thing. Metal on the biting surface because we know that's not going to chip. If you look at all these holes, you're probably wondering what these are. These are the screw access holes, right? Because these bridges are screwed to place. So I can grind out this filling, I can remove them, and do anything that I need to repair or modify the prosthesis. When you look at it from the side, you don't see that metal, right? You're seeing the porcelain on this aspect of it. Okay. Last 5 minutes, we're going to just quickly show you some of the cancer patients that I treat. We're going to talk about the upper jaw, the lower jaw, and facial prosthesis. This is a person who had a cancer of their sinus. Part of the upper jaw is missing. You know, a denture is going to be hard to stay in most people's mouths, but there's only half a jaw. This denture is not going to stay up. There's no suction. So an implant is going to help hold what we call an obturator prosthesis in this patient's mouth so they can function pretty well from it. One of the largest ones that I've done, a lot of surgery, big tumor. All that remains of the upper jaw was this little portion. We were able to put some implants. Now, with this patient, do I expect this patient to chew effectively with this? No. The purpose of this prosthesis is to allow this patient to be able to speak and to be able to swallow. Because if they can't wear a denture in their mouth and they've got that big hole, anything they swallow is going to come out of their nose, and they're going to speak as if air is coming out through their nose, right? So the idea is to close up or obturate the hole. And implants have really helped these patients a lot because without implants, this prosthesis would not stay in place. If people have their own teeth, it works great because you can anchor onto the teeth. But if they don't, implants are a huge benefit to them. This is a patient with a cleft palate. Older patient who had was not treated surgically like we would today. There's a hole in the front of the mouth. There's a hole in the soft palate at the back. They need a very large prosthesis that looks something like this because this bulb has to obturate or seal off the defect so they can speak effectively. This patient had her own teeth, but when she started to lose her teeth, the two teeth that remained were not adequate to hold something like this in place. So having implants and making a bar has really allowed this patient to function normally that we wouldn't be able to do so. This is a patient who had cancer as well, and she didn't have enough jawbone to put an implant in, so there's something called the zygomatic implant that Professor Brånemark came up with. And if you look at this, this implant is really long and really sideways, right? Because she's got this whole jaw was missing, there's no bone for us to put them in. So these implants are 40 or 50 millimeters long, they're anchored into the zygomatic arch, your cheekbone all the way up here, right? So the implant goes up there, comes into the mouth, we can attach a bar to it and have a prosthesis that allows this patient to function. Lower jaw, much more predictable. Cancer, part of the jaw was removed. Jaw was reconstructed. We were able to put implants, make a bar, and make a prosthesis. The side of the jaw, same thing. Jaw removed, bony reconstruction, implants. Lower jaw, resected from cancer. Again, implant restoration is placed in their mouth. Only showing you this to show you what we do here at UCSF in these sort of group of patients that are not common out there to everybody else. This is a young man. He was 17 years old. He had what's called a sarcoma. It was growing in his lower jawbone. The lower jawbone had to be removed as part of that. It was reconstructed and implants were placed. We were able to make him, again, an overdenture because, as you can tell, he's missing all this gum that I need to replace, right? Same sort of concept, same sort of idea applied to a more difficult situation for us to treat. What do we do today that's different? So this is a patient who had a tumor in the floor of his mouth, part of the tongue, and invading the lower jaw, you can see on this scan. The surgical resection takes out the entire front of the lower jaw. We're able to reconstruct that today with a team effort where they take bone from the leg, they harvest bone from the leg, transfer that bone up. It's microvascular surgery, so that piece of bone is connected to the vessels in the neck, and it's alive on day one. We're able to put implants in that patient's jawbone, and then we're able to give him some teeth on a bar and an overdenture that allows him to function properly. His teeth were crooked before we started, right? This is not something that happened. That's how we presented with early on. Okay, so you wonder what this next bit is all about. Dentists, prosthodontists like me, way back from the First World War, were involved in doing facial prostheses. They were done on soldiers. In the First World War, it was known as the trench warfare. If any of you follow, you know, they were in trenches, but they'd put their head up to look out, and their head would get shot out. They'd get shot in the face, and they'd lose their ear, they'd lose their nose, they'd lose part of their face. And dentists were part of the army out there. And the process of making facial prostheses was the same. You made a mold, used an impression material, you poured up a model, you had plaster, you worked with wax, you created the shape of what was missing, and you converted that into plastic, rubber, or today what we do, silicone. But most of those were held on by glues, adhesives, glass frames, elastic bands. But implants has changed that, because we can actually use an implant that is much smaller, that we can place in different parts of the face in bone, and then make the same silicone prostheses that can be anchored to place very well. So that's something I do here as well. This is a patient who had a melanoma. Part of the ear was lost. We did make him a traditional ear prosthesis, but it was very difficult for him to glue on to the side of his face. So he wanted implants. We were able to place an implant here and here. We made a bar. This is a magnet. So you've got this is the surface of the ear that's going to fit against the skin. This is a magnet that would snap on here, a clip that was attached to the bar, and then he can place this on and be able to restore part of the ear that's missing. You know, and so these are basically cosmetic things to replace part of the facial structure, so these patients are able to go. We do this. Sorry, you have to block out eyes these days, so these eyes show up. This is a patient who was missing her nose from a cancer, and you can see I was able to get implants in here, and then a nasal prosthesis that snaps onto it so it can be removed and cleaned easily. We could do it for eyes. We've done it for part of the face. You know, the idea is, obviously, these are not going to be perfect, but they're more presentable in society than they are walking around with nothing on their face. Last part we're going to talk about is failure. The important part to understand is what fails. So the first kind of failure is what we're going to call biological failure. The second type of failure is what we're going to call mechanical failure. And we're seeing more of these mechanical failures. It's stress. When you have an implant that bends and breaks, right? If you design this inadequately, where the force is too much, there is a chance that this piece of titanium, like a paper clip, is going to bend and it's going to break, right? And so we're looking at better designs of implants, maybe alloying them with something so that they're stronger to work with. So that's a mechanical failure, because anything we put in your mouth, we cannot promise you that it's going to keep working all along, right? But we need to understand what failure occurs. So here is a patient who's got an implant tooth. It's been there for about 8 years. He calls me up and says, my tooth is loose. He comes in, I look at it, and I thought maybe the screw that was holding the crown in place was loose, but it really wasn't the case. The implant had fractured. This is a real problem, because what the heck do we do now? I can't make a tooth that's going to get attached to this anymore, because you can see this is the part that fractured and this is the crown that sits on it. And basically, the option is to take this implant out. And that's not so easy, because the implant's actually integrated to the bone. It's like part of the bone. So to get it out, you have to get what we call a trephine, or like a apple core. It has to go in around that implant and cut all that out. And it's pretty traumatic. So we chose, and he agreed with us, to leave it alone. We just left it and made a bridge to replace the tooth. So let's talk about biological failure, because that's an important part to understand, right? We said that the bone grows onto the surface of this titanium, and it stays that way. What makes it stay that way? What happens if your physiology changes? What happens if the bone that you normally have that's attached to this body doesn't have that normal turnover again? Is it going to survive? Right? That's part of the problem. So when we look at biological failure, what we say is it's inadequacy of the host tissue to establish or maintain osseointegration. We separate those two things out. So when we say establish, we're going to say that's early failure, and maintain is more late failure or long term. So what would early failure be? You were a patient, we drilled the bone, we put the screw in, We covered the gum up. We let you go for the 3 months, 4 months, 6 months, whatever we thought was adequate. You came back. We exposed the implant, and the implant was loose. It just fell right out. So for whatever reason, your body or your bone did not grow to the surface of that implant. It was a biological failure, failure to establish integration. It could have been maybe the dentist used the drill too fast and killed some of the bone. Maybe your bone metabolism was not appropriate. We have some instances where people who are taking Fosamax, right, to prevent osteoporosis, that stops the cycle of how the bone heals. In those patients, implants don't do that well because what Fosamax is doing is it's slowing down calcium breakdown. That's what it's supposed to do. And so the osteoclastic activity is changing. So implants may not work so well in that group of patients. Late failure is interesting. You put an implant in, the implant's integrated. I make a tooth on it. The tooth seems fine. You come back 2 years later, the implant is loose. What happened? Well, what happened is failure to maintain, because in that particular patient, maybe the load that was applied was too much, too great for this bone implant interface to tolerate, right? So it broke down. It was there, it was integrated, but as you started chewing on it and putting more load on it, more pressure on it, it broke down. It couldn't stand the test of time. Unfortunately, we have no way of predicting that on a patient. We have no way of identifying you're going to get an early failure or late failure. We know that the Fosamax story that I told you, there's a slightly lower success rate, so we will warn patients about that. We know people who are smokers have a higher failure rate because their ability to heal is not so good. We know patients who are uncontrolled diabetics don't have a good success rate, right? Because all of those conditions are situations where patients' capacity to heal is not normal. So if the capacity to heal of your body is not normal, you will have potentially a lower success rate. We know patients who've had radiation therapy in the head and neck area for a cancer are not going to do well with implants because the radiation therapy has killed off some of those cells, right? So those are situations that we worry about. The last part is cleaning. So most of these people who lost their teeth because they didn't take good care of their teeth in the first place. They didn't brush well, right? They didn't have good oral hygiene. They didn't visit the dentist. Whatever. So they built up, and so they've got a history, or maybe just genetically they were more prone to having disease and losing their teeth. So it's important that when we put these restorations in your mouth, we still maintain good oral hygiene. We have to be able to give you the tools. We have to be able to bring you back for this. So you can see when you take bridges off, if people don't clean them, there's tartar and calculus just like they would be in your teeth. Most of our patients have to come and see a hygienist every 6 months, maybe every 3 months. And that's a challenge because some of these patients are older. They may have been wearing dentures for 30 years of their life. They've never really held a toothbrush. They don't know how to brush. They can't see so well. Their manual dexterity may be compromised. We have to think of those choices, those problems when we select the patient. So cleaning is very, very important. We give our patients a whole bunch of tools that they have to take in. And the fact that you go to your dentist and you get your implants, you're not done. Right? It's sort of a bad analogy, but you buy a car, you got to go back to get it serviced. And the more expensive the car, the more expensive the service. And what I mean here is the more complex your prosthetic treatment, the more implants, bone graft, complex procedure from the restorative side, if things are going to break down, it's going to be more expensive to repair them. So there's costs associated with that. Right? Big toolkits that patients walk away with. So, you know, we think implants are so good. I used to use this slide to joke that the Golden Gate Bridge, and maybe I got to change that slide to our new Bay Bridge, because if they'd used titanium for those rods, we wouldn't be having all this discussion. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.